And since what we're exploring and experience is this body and mind, the body and mind processes tumbling on, I'd like to continue exploring this human experience through the framework of the five aggregates today, and use as the basic theme or structure of the talk a sutta that in particular points to the emptiness, insubstantiality of the five aggregates and the importance of seeing that emptiness, insubstantiality, and how that supports us. I want to just say a few words about this idea of emptiness. It's in the Theravada, I would say it's not really considered a metaphysical reality, because the Theravada and the Sutta perspective is really much more about what is the experience, not what's actually out there. So not what is the nature of what's out there. The Buddhist teachings are interested in the nature of experience. And in this teaching, it's pointing to the emptiness, the insubstantiality of experience. And this can be understood or pointed to as basically without inherent existence, that whatever is arising in our experience, in connection, this understanding comes in connection with the conditioned nature of our experience. Because every experience that arises here, whatever is arising here, is arising in dependence upon other conditions. And so there's nothing that exists independent of anything else. No thing here to identify and say, this is such and such, this is such and such. Every experience, every aspect of what happens here is arising due to conditions, passing away when conditions fall apart. And this is a big aspect of what's pointed to when the teachings in the Theravada refer to emptiness. So there are other traditions, other Buddhist traditions that have perhaps grander meanings for emptiness. And yet the understanding that is being pointed to here is profoundly freeing. And that is really my sense of what the Buddha was pointing to. He's not so interested in coming up with some description about the empty nature of the world, of like what reality is. He's interested in pointing us to understandings that free the mind from suffering. And so emptiness is not some goal, not some like thing we aim to get or touch or understand in terms of this is the answer or this is what we need to understand. The understanding of emptiness is a condition that supports the mind releasing craving and clinging. That's its function. Another definition of emptiness, when the Buddha was asked by Ananda at one point. The Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed to him, sat to one side. He was sitting there. He said to the Blessed One, "It is said the world is empty." And in the Buddhist, in the Theravada teachings, in the suttas, the use of the word world here, there's another place where the Buddha said, "What I call the world is this fathom-long body with its experience." And so this is the world that's being referred to here. It is said that the world is empty. The world is empty. In what respect is it said that the world is empty? Insofar as it is empty of self or anything pertaining to self, thus it is said that the world is empty. So this is another definition of emptiness in the Theravada. Empty of self or what pertains to self. And this is very relevant in terms of the teaching of the five aggregates, this understanding of emptiness of self, because the teaching on the five aggregates is one of the key ways that the Buddha used to support us to understand how do we misconstrue these five aggregates as a self. That is not the topic for today. It'll probably be the topic another day. And I wanted to kind of just cover the meanings, the various meanings of emptiness in the Theravada. So I'd say the biggest kind of the highlights here, meaning insubstantial, without inherent existence, conditioned, basically, that the conditioned nature of experience, empty of self, and what belongs to self. And these three actually kind of interrelate, because the conditioned nature of experience, the recognition as we begin to recognize and see intention arising and action following and thoughts arising and feelings being shaped by that, and the whole way this experience is just conditions tumbling on, we begin to directly see there's not what we think of as self in there. And so this teaching that I'd like to explore with you today is a teaching on similes related to the five aggregates. And what I'd like to do is to I think I'll just read the sutta with the similes here. Let that land. And then we'll go through a couple of them today. I'm not going to try to go through all of them. So just know that, because at some point you will have been sitting here for, 40 minutes, and I'll still be on feeling tone, and you might get a little nervous, so. So these are the words of the Buddha. And it is said that the Buddha was sitting, this sutta was given when the Buddha was sitting by the river Ganges, and he saw, sitting there, he saw a lump of foam floating down the river. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling on the bank of the river Ganges. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhu, suppose that this river Ganges were carrying along a great lump of foam. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, whatever kind of form there is, whether past or future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in form? So each of these, in this case, it's a simile that is, each of these five aggregates is connected to a particular simile, a particular analogy. And we'll explore how they're related as we go. Suppose that in the autumn, when it was raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? So too, whatever kind of feeling there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in feeling? Suppose that in the last month of the hot season, at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance can there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past or future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in perception? Suppose that a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would take a sharp axe and enter the forest. There they would see the trunk of a large plantain tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unroll the coil, they would not find even soft wood, let alone hard wood. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in the trunk of a plantain tree? So too, whatever kind of volitional formations there are, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects them, ponders them, and carefully investigates them. As one investigates them, they appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in volitional formations? Suppose that a magician or magician's apprentice would display a magical illusion at a crossroads. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in consciousness? Form is like a lump of foam, feeling like a water bubble. Perception is like a mirage, volitions like a plantain trunk, and consciousness like an illusion. However one may ponder it and carefully investigate it, it appears but hollow and void when one views it carefully. So, the body, like a lump of foam. Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A great lump of foam. One day, I was out at the beach. It was a march. I was teaching the March month long at Spirit Rock, and on a day where I didn't have a practice discussion meetings, one of my fellow teachers and I went out to the beach. And it happened to be on this day a very cold and windy day. We were really bundled up. And the waves were just crashing, and the wind had really whipped up the water. There were these great lumps of foam being blown into the air and deposited on the beach. Some of these lumps of foam were the size of this desk, this table. They were huge. And then they were blown down the beach. And as they were blown down the beach, they just vanished. They looked so substantial. This is, I think, a point of one of the points of these similes that the Buddha points to here. These similes point to the way the way each aggregate kind of deceives us or deludes us. So these similes kind of point to the deluding nature, the way delusion enters in with each of these aggregates. So it's an important teaching in this way. And so the lump of foam looks substantial. You look at it from a distance, it's a big lump of foam sitting on the water, floating there. And in this case, I had my cell phone with me, so I took some videos, and it was just so stunning to see these huge lumps of foam just as they got blown down the beach. It's like until they vanished. And so as you look at something, as you look at the lump of foam more carefully, so from a distance, when you're not looking at it carefully, it looks solid. It looks substantial. But when you actually look a little more closely or get to witness something like this wind blowing it down the beach, or try to pick it up with your hand, pop, 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 all the bubbles just pop, 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 disintegrate as you put your hand through it. And so, too, the Buddha is pointing to this body seems substantial, solid, when it's not observed carefully. But when we do start to observe it carefully, we start to see its insubstantial nature. And so, looking at what actual body experience is, the Buddha's encouragement, whatever kind of form there is, one inspects it carefully, investigates it. And so this is the work. I talked a little about investigation this morning as being something that needs to be done, not to dive in and dig and pull apart. But as we, as the mindfulness gets more continuous and there is this sense of curiosity, it's like that curiosity and that continuous mindfulness will do the investigation. And so really it is this careful, meeting of experience, observing experience, looking at it, not taking anything for granted about it. What is the experience of body? We start to observe that and look at it. And when we experience, look at our body, what is the actual sensation? Not the concept, because it is so easy to experience our body through concept. We We think, oh yeah, I'm feeling my hand or my foot. But when we actually look at that area of the physical form, put the attention in the area that we call hand. Maybe you could do this right now. What do you experience? What is the experience of that part of the form called hand? Not thinking about it as hand, but the actual sensations. Coolness. Pulsing, maybe. Vibrating. Tingling. Is it solid? Does it feel stable? Sometimes we can kind of maybe just for a little bit, you know, pick a little place on the hand and see, you know, landing on some area where the sensation feels a little stronger. What is the sensation? And can you actually find a sensation that lasts? Maybe you find a sensation there that feels like it's lasting, but keep looking at it. It starts to change, shift, fluctuate. This is the nature of physical experience. We often relate to our physical experience through the concept of our experience, the body. We relate to it through the parts of the body. Yeah, right now, if you look at your hand and think about it as hand, do the sensations change? I mean, when I look at my hand now, so I'd like you to do that. You know, you've been feeling into the hand. Now look at it and think about what hands do. They reach, they touch, they pick things up. What happens to the sensations? They often get more remote because we are experiencing the hand, not only through the sight, but also through the concept, hands and what they do. Likewise, in the physicality of sight, sound, you know, hearing, we hear a truck, motorcycle, maybe that is, and in the hearing of it, I think I still barely hear it, and so the hearing of it, you know, has a fluctuating kind of dynamic experience. But when we think about it as motorcycle, the image of motorcycle comes into our mind. We think about it as something that's out there. We may not understand the experience as impermanent because we are focused on or connected with the idea of motorcycle. And so in form, the insubstantiality of form is partly related to this very dynamic experience of body. When we touch into the actuality of the experience of body, this is reminiscent of the the Buddhist teachings to Bahia, a brief teaching where the Buddha offered instructions about how to be with experience. And the Buddha said, one recognizes or one knows, this is how you should train. In the body is only the body. In the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. And so seeing, hearing, sensing, making up the experience of body. Sensing including not only physical touch, but smell and taste. And the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. This is this exploration of the meeting of experience below the level of concept. So what is the experience of body? Touching into that, sensing the insubstantial flux nature of that experience. There is nothing solid in the experience of body. And two, we can reflect, and the Buddha actually encourages us to reflect on the insubstantiality of body in a more gross way, in a more obvious way, because, you know, on the surface of it, maybe for, it's like, yeah, well, the sensations don't seem very solid, but I know this body actually is solid. I know this body is solid. I mean, those bones, they're pretty firm. They're pretty solid. And so the Buddha encourages us to reflect on the decay of the body of a corpse and what happens to it. It falls apart. And so even the solidity of this body becomes earth and water and air. We can reflect on this from the perspective of what we know from science. That this body is 97% water, maybe? I don't remember exactly, something like that. Lots of air in there too. So this form here, looking so solid, maybe 3% solidity. If we, you know, burn the corpse, that's the matter, the mass of what's there. All of the water and air go out of it. We don't get that much form. So even this, that looks pretty substantial. We can reflect on the insubstantiality in this way also. In addition to the experience of insubstantiality, it can sometimes help us to reflect on the physical insubstantiality of the body. And then also there is the sense of conditionality of this being. The body comes in, and this body at some point was an egg and a sperm. And it grew, emerged from the womb, package about this size. Grows, changes over time. Again, this changing form, not stable. May seem stable for a particular time, but, you know, as some of us are aging right now, not all of us in this room are in this situation, but some of us are aging, at the end of our lives, we also start feeling the changing nature of the body. And then, too, we can reflect, again, from the kind of science perspective, the perspective of science, the perspective of understanding the elements, the elements of what makes up our body. Hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. Those are most of them, I think. Probably some others in there. Those atoms, every single atom in our body, originated from a star. The stars in this universe are the creators of the elements in a very real sense. As Carl Sagan says, we are made of star stuff. This being in flux, the elements that make up this being for a time arranged in this way, and soon to be returned to the universe as carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And so another way of, and so we can use reflection in addition to understand this, or to kind of grok or grasp this insubstantiality. Reflection can be a pretty powerful tool for us, just to remind us of the insubstantial nature of our experience, of our body. And then at the experience level, also the conditionality of experience. There's a teaching based on the I and forms. So there's this I in our body. There's form and light. Based on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. These three come together as contact, and we feel and perceive that experience of seeing. And so this is the conditions around seeing. Likewise with the physical, based on the body and tactile objects, the meeting of three is consciousness. There's consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. In the realm of the eye, without the light, we don't see. So the conditioned nature of experience, of our physical experience. What do we grasp at when we grasp at the body? And this is a useful consideration, because much of the time we're not really grasping at the actual physical, those fleeting sensations of vibration and pulsing and tingling, and those blips of form and color and pitch and tone and the hearing. We're grasping at, what kind of bird is that? So the sound of the bird, and then we're leaning into not the sound itself mostly, but some idea or some thought, some concept. And we grasp at body image, how we like our body to look, as if from the outside, how others perceive us. When we kind of touch into this, insubstantial nature of the actual experience of body. It seems as though the concepts and ideas about, you know, the, you know, just the sensations of sitting here, just this experience of vibration, pulsing, tingling, maybe sometimes pleasant or unpleasant, but, you know, anything wrong with that? Anything problem about the vibration and pulsing and tingling? We tend to make problems around our ideas, not the actual experience. There are times when touching into the actual experience can be disturbing or frightening, partly because the touching into the deep instability of actual experience is very unsettling. We don't like that instability. We don't like that sense of nothing to hold on to, nowhere to land. As we touch into the direct experience of the physicality and do experience this in unsubstantial nothing with inherent existence, impermanent, unreliable, we touch into that, we realize there's nowhere to cling. And yet we so want something to cling to because of that movement, clinging. Clinging has convinced us we need something stable to hold to in order to be happy. Is this a delusion that craving and clinging hold, embedded in craving and clinging? And so sometimes it's disturbing to meet that dynamic experience of the physicality. And yet, the beginning to see that, really see it, as our mind does relax and meet that and feels into the, sometimes it just might feel like sand streaming, like, you know, through a, what do they call those things? Hourglass. Just feels like sand streaming through an hourglass. No, nothing still, just streaming. And as we come into alignment with that is actually what's happening. There's a release that is peace. And this is the release of that tendency to cling to something that is not possible to cling to. And so understanding this empty, insubstantial nature of form supports, and of all of the aggregates as we understand the empty, insubstantial nature, it supports the letting go of the clinging. We see there isn't anything to cling to. The mind begins to give up its project of clinging when it sees there's no point. So the next one, the feeling. Suppose that in the autumn, when it is raining and big drops of rain are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. Feeling is like that water bubble. For me, the analogy of the body being like foam I meant to mention this earlier, but actually it was kind of a surprise to me at one point as I really was touching in. At one point I was right with the breath on one retreat and feeling all of the sensations in there. And at some point, the experience there, it felt like bubbles popping. That was the experience of the body as the movement happened. Of the rising and falling of the abdomen. And very much in my mind, the lump of foam. It was like, wow, you know, the Buddha, that analogy, the lump of foam, it's really, it's just right. It's dead on. That's what it feels like. That's what the body feels like when looked at, you know, in this way. It's pop, 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 pop. The feeling as an airy bubble. I haven't quite felt into this one in that way. There's some comments about it, you know, what it points to. One place, the in one exploration of it, it says that it looks like the bubble, you know, floating on the surface of the water looks like it's you know, something that it's there, right? It's sitting there and you could pick it up. But as soon as you try to pick it up again, it just, poof, it vanishes. And we also know that it's largely empty. It's mostly just this thin film, existing in dependence on conditions. The drop coming from, at one point at the 3-month course, a really rainy day, I was sitting outside at IMS and watching the water drops drop into a big puddle and seeing these bubbles arise and float and then vanish. And so the recognizing the conditionality of those bubbles, they arise as a drop kind of lands and hits and it kind of bursts a little bit of air and the water kind of comes into that stretched dome. And as long it lingers as long as the conditions are available for it to linger, and then it just vanishes. And so the conditionality there of that water bubble connecting to the conditionality of feeling, and perhaps a little bit again pointing to the deluding nature, if this simile is pointing to the deluding nature of how we might cling to feeling, you know, it appears to linger, you know, it appears to hang out for a little while, giving us the idea that, oh yeah, there's something I can like land on here. In actuality, feeling is coming and going very quickly, but in our experience, there's a way in which our mind kind of latches onto it and it feels like it lingers, and we feel like we can orient around that lingering feeling to hold on to it. But then as we try to hold on to it, we see, we recognize that, you know, this feeling, this like, it takes so much energy to try to keep that feeling going. There's suffering in that. And it will disappear. It does vanish. And so again, exploring we talked a little bit about feeling this morning in the guided meditation. A few more pieces about feeling and investigating this experience. All of this is an encouragement to investigate the actual experience. Investigate the actual experience of body sensation and seeing and hearing, tasting. Investigate the experience of feeling. Every experience, as I've said, physical, mental, comes with feeling. So there's lots of opportunity. It's not like we have to look for it. It may be that we have to orient to recognizing it. We don't have to make it happen, but sometimes it's a subtle enough phenomenon that it kind of flies under our radar, and so it doesn't actually come to our surface of seeing it. But it happens with every single experience. So that orientation, that curiosity, what is the feeling of this experience, can be an investigation in the way I spoke about this morning. And I said a number of times, but haven't quite elaborated on feeling being a mental phenomenon. You know, this is easy to see or understand when we are noticing mind states. You know, it's easy to recognize the feeling of the pleasantness of happiness as a mental happiness. It's easy to recognize the feeling of unpleasantness associated with anger or frustration as mental phenomenon. Not as easy to notice the feeling associated with touch sense as a mental phenomenon. I read a study that pointed to how we can begin to understand feeling as a mental phenomenon. So there was a study where they had participants in the study experiencing different levels of unpleasant experience. The first was just a mild stimulation, and then there was like the level of like touch, the experience of touching a too hot cup of coffee, so that a little more strong. And they were told before each experience, you know, each time they got shocked, they were told what level of pain they would be experiencing. And they reported, you know, the pain levels in congruence with what they were experiencing. I think I'm getting this right. In any case, it's the right flavor. And then the next time around, they told them, at times they told them that they would be giving them a strong shock, but it actually gave them a weak one. And in reporting that description of the experience, in reporting that, what they felt there, they reported that it was pleasant. The light shock was pleasant. And the researchers were kind of surprised, and they theorized, and I think this is probably a pretty good theory, that the expectation of getting a strong shock, having been kind of braced for, that when they got the weak shock, there was a relief. And the relief is pleasant. And so it may not have been actually that, you know, the physical sensation is the same. The perception of it is different depending on expectation. In this case, in this study. And actually they were reporting something unpleasant, an unpleasant shock, as pleasant, given certain conditions. And so this points to the conditionality of feeling tone, and that it is a construct of the mind. So physical shock, if the pleasant and unpleasant were strictly the physical, there wouldn't be this naming or labeling of it or interpreting it as pleasant. And they even actually noticed that the kind of they were doing some extra things, checking in the EEGs for kind of startle responses and reactions. And the reaction in the brain was like pleasure for those shocks as well. So it wasn't just their reporting. It was what the brain felt too. And so our expectations, our views can really shape our feeling tone. So there's no inherent reality to the feeling tone in our physical experience. It is shaped based on views, conditioning, perceptions. And so this is the conditionality of feeling tone. This is one of the ways in which it too is empty. It has no inherent feeling. It's not like the feeling exists in that shock. The feeling is conditioned depending on all kinds of things coming together. And so this is the insubstantial, conditioned nature of feeling tone, again, pointing to this emptiness, the emptiness of feeling. And so some of the different ways that feeling is shaped or conditioned, shaped by perception. I'm just briefly reminding you of the snake and rope analogy or situation. You walk into a room, see the snake, see what you think of as snake. There will be fear and unpleasant experience. So unpleasant, independence on that perception. Then we discover that it wasn't a snake at all, it was a rope. The perception shifts, the feeling shifts, independence on that perception. Views and beliefs are huge shapers of feeling tone. So not only how we perceive things, but what we think about things shapes the feelings that happen. At one point, I was meditating late at night in my room. And while I was meditating, I heard a tapping sound that seemed to be coming from the wall, inside the wall. And my experience was that that tapping was very quiet, you know, just this little tap, 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 quiet tapping sound. My experience was that it was unpleasant. There's a little bit of bracing and constriction. And I noticed that. I was just noticing it. Noticed the unpleasantness of the sound. Noticed the unpleasantness of the constriction. That was clearly unpleasant. And then the tapping went away, and I just meditated for a while. And the tapping came back, and I felt the whole thing arise again. Noticed it, watched it. At some point, I noticed when the tapping happened that there was a flash of fear. And I think something like an image of a rat in the wall making that sound. And the mind felt fear very clearly. I had not felt fear before. I'd felt this kind of constriction, but I'd not clearly felt fear. I had experienced the tapping as unpleasant and the body constriction as unpleasant. I was interpreting the constriction to be, oh, that sound, why does that sound have to keep going on? But then there was this little, you know, flash of fear in connection with what the mind was thinking the sound was about. And that fear was real. That was clearly unpleasant. That was really unpleasant. The fear was very unpleasant. And having seen that, the next time I heard the tapping sound, the experience of that tapping sound was neutral, maybe even slightly pleasant. It was just this quiet tap, tap, tap. And I could see that the fear and the reactivity and the sense of it being an unpleasant sound had to do not with the sound itself, but with a whole construct and view about what that sound was about. This is a lot of how our feelings come to be. This kind of view, belief, ideas about what should be, shouldn't be. Senses about what things are, how we're perceiving them. A poet's description of this kind of thing. This is Billy Collins. And the title of the poem is Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. And maybe you'll have a sense of why I remembered this poem. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony, full blast. But I can still hear him, muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for a barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. Perception influencing, views influencing, feeling. Most of our reactivity to feeling comes out of mental reactivity. As this poem points to, the idea of the neighbors switching him on their way out, you know, that sense of, can't they make this stop? And the whole notion, the idea of it. The actual sound is just barking, barking, barking. Sometimes there, sometimes not. A little pause between each bark. Little pause. So we might, for instance, have a reaction or react to what we think of as sound. Somebody getting up and making, you know, what we think of as loud noises as they leave the hall. What is the actual reactivity to? Is it actually the sound? There are times when sound can be painful, when it's like such a strong sound that it's damaging the eardrum. But most of the time, sound is more neutral. It's kind of like, even actually the teachings in the Buddhist psychology in the Abhidhamma point to saying that sight and sound are actually, in their bare experience, they're neutral, and that any kind of pleasant or unpleasant that arises based on sound or sight or smell or taste, also they say in the Abhidhamma, is neutral, and that any sense of pleasant or unpleasant comes because of a concept or an idea. Maybe we can get a sense of this in looking at a flower. You know, what's coming into our eyes is just form and color. The idea, the interpretation of it as a flower, maybe associations of flower, that is shaping whether we take it as pleasant or unpleasant. The actual experience is form and color, just really neutral experience. And I'm not sure I fully believe that teaching, but it's really interesting to explore, to look at when we are reacting to what we think of as reacting to physical experience. What are we actually reacting to? So much of the time we see some idea, like the person getting up to leave the hall. The sound is the sound. And often what we're reacting to is the idea of they shouldn't make that much noise. That idea is unpleasant. The sense of somebody impinging on me is unpleasant. Most of our reactivity comes out of perceptions or our relationship to perceptions, views, ideas, opinions, mental phenomena, not the actual physical experience. Even physical unpleasant experience, if we're reactive to that, often it's more about the idea of, oh no, this is a problem. I don't have time for this. I don't have time to go to the hospital and get this finger stitched up. I have things to do. The sensation's unpleasant, and some of that there is a pain associated with that. But reactivity to that, maybe some of it comes from the actual physical unpleasant experience. Most of it comes from what's going on in the mind. And so this exploration of feeling tone, the exploration of how does feeling tone come to be? We really start to see it is so conditioned. A feeling tone might change over the course of 5 minutes sitting in this room. You might come in initially and feel, after being outside, you might feel, oh, pleasant coolness. And then you sit here for a while, and if you didn't have a shawl with you, it's like unpleasant coolness. Conditions changing. Same experience here with different conditions being shaped, feeling shaped, changing dynamically. No inherent stability to feeling. That airy bubble there while conditions are there and then vanishing. And so, to be continued tomorrow. Thank you.